This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The Goat's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Welcome, my lovelies, to another Liner Note Leftovers, your virtual crate digging experience where we get into the weird facts, pulp knowledge, and minutiae of rock and roll. This is episode 15, aka Foxy Davey, which is a weird, weird title from the outset, but it's going to connect in more than one way to the stories I got for you this week. We got what's in a name when it comes to Led Zeppelin, and how basically the person who thought of it was entirely screwing around at the time. Why Jimmy Hendrix never worked as an opening act, or whoever they chose to follow him was a terrible, terrible idea as a headliner. Our first Foxy Davey, so to speak. And the second Foxy Davey is the story of David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust, which gave you weird feelings no matter which way you slice it. But that was kind of the point. More to come, but first off, we're going to drop that needle right away and get into another Liner Note Leftovers. July 4th, 1976. Huge, huge day, and I'm not talking about the Murica Bicentennial. Because while the US was celebrating and dunking on England, England was getting ready to dunk back on America with the beginnings of the UK punk scene. And it all can be traced back, punk going from a spattering of bands and people in the scene to a worldwide phenomenon. To one fateful show on that day when the Clash opened up for the Sex Pistols, but by the end, the Clash was the bigger band. So July 4th, 1976, the first show the Clash ever played. One person who wants this show to go really, really well is Joe Strummer, who had actually already met the Sex Pistols and been blown out of the water by them. Check this out. Before the Clash, Joe Strummer was in a pub rock group called the 101ers. They shared the stage with the Sex Pistols, and within 5 seconds of the first song, according to Joe Strummer, he knew 101ers were yesterday's papers. They were over. Strummer immediately quits, and they begin forming what's known as the Clash, which he wants to use to go toe-to-toe with the Sex Pistols, the new flag banner for punk rock, this fledgling music style. And aside from those shoes to fill, the Clash is really nervous because they've never played a show in public before. Bassist Paul Simonon actually didn't even know how to tune his bass. Mick Jones had to come help him out midway through the show. But despite that, the papers after the gig spoke for themselves because the review said, "The Clash are the first band to come along who will really frighten the Sex Pistols." They were referred to as the gleaming and unstoppable bastard of the Pistols and the Ramones with the firepower of status quo. And this was because, in addition to the classic rebellious lyrics of punk rock, the angry and fast playing style, and the capturing of a feeling in England at the time, the Clash also had some technical virtuosity to them. They knew how to play their instruments. Their backgrounds were more diverse into things like not only punk, but pub rock, rockabilly, even some reggae influence there. Whereas the Sex Pistols, for everything great that they did and the feeling that they captured of the time, could barely play three chords among them, and Sid Vicious couldn't play a bass at all. Half the time it was some guy backstage playing for him while Sid pretended. But either way, at that time, something big was happening, and this rivalry set up the punk rock rebellion as we knew it. Also, fun fact, one day after this show, so July 5th, 1976, the Ramones make their first trip to England. They all play on the same bill, and the forever debate of what's better, US punk rock or British punk rock, began that very night. Now, eventually, the Sex Pistols would completely implode on themselves, but this new band, The Clash, sticking out like a sore thumb in the punk rock revolution, picked up the mantle and led the charge in a style of music that we always say isn't dead, just kind of smells that way. With the dude or not, we all gotta admit, Neil Young is the kind of dude that speaks his mind. And that has caused troubles for the man from time to time, but perhaps one of the most prevalent examples of that is when he took on literally everybody in the song This Note's For You, which on July 6th, 1988, MTV said, "We will never play on our station." Which you come at Neil Young like that, you know there's gonna be some headbutts, because this song is pretty special to the guy. It was originally developed as a riff in short blue sets on the 87 Crazy Horse Tour, during which Neil Young became very happy with the results and reactions to the lyrics. In fact, going so far as to say, quote, "The crowd was going nuts and no one was shouting for Southern Man like they'd done throughout my whole career." So Neil Young lays this song down, and it is a scathing indictment of artists that sell their songs to promote products like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Miller Beer, potato chips, whatever. And in fact, if you watch the video, there are direct attacks at Calvin Klein Obsession commercials that rock stars appeared in. Neil Young comes for Eric Clapton by name by parodying the Night Belongs to Michelob ads that he was in. And of course, he got a dig in at Michael Jackson's hair being lit on fire during that Pepsi commercial. And Neil Young is ready to let this thing roll. He wants it on MTV, but MTV says no. And according to GM Lee Masters, he said, "Everybody loved it here. It was great, and it was but the problem is, our attorneys advised us against using the likeness of Michael Jackson and Spuds McKenzie, and we don't want to get sued." Which everybody thought was kind of weird, because at the time, MTV was airing Weird Al's Fat, which is a direct spoof of Bad by Michael Jackson. And Canada's MTV, Much Music, already had it in deep rotation with no hint of a lawsuit. So everybody started to believe, oh, you want those Pepsi and Miller Lite dollars. You don't care about Michael Jackson or Spuds McKenzie or whatever. In fact, Neil Young goes so far as to send a letter to the networks saying, "You're spineless twerps. You refuse to play this notes for you because you're afraid to offend sponsors. What does the M in MTV stand for? Music or money? Long live rock and roll." But strangely enough, for getting in a beef with MTV, the song gets more attention than any Neil Young song had since Russ Never Sleeps, which came out in the 70s. It was the start of the Neil Young revival that would continue with things like Rockin' in the Free World. And eventually, MTV not only backed down by playing the song, but also giving it Video of the Year at their MTV Video Music Awards. Neil Young was on tour at the time, so he accepted via satellite, but with one last dig, if you're a conspiratorial like that, the audio somehow dropped out midway through his acceptance speech and he couldn't finish. They said it was a tech error, but who else thinks that's a little suspect? But suspect or not, was the biggest Neil Young hit in years and years, and in fact became sort of a thing in the cultural lexicon, where "This Note's For You" was used to call out rock stars that had sold out. Just nobody tell David Lee Roth that, because when he was asked in an interview about his own corporate sponsorship by Toshiba, citing "This Note's For You," he said, "That's just hippie bull from the 60s. If your message is not strong enough to transcend a soda pop commercial, you got problems." Someone's a little touchy, right? Jeez. You know, it's always interesting to consider what's in a name. Finger 11 was almost the Rainbow Butt Monkeys. Nirvana was almost called Skid Row until they realized they didn't want to share their name with a hair metal band. And if a whole bunch of serendipitous moments didn't happen, Led Zeppelin would have almost been the new Yardbirds. And would they have had the same appeal if they kept that name? Who knows? But the name we know and love them under might have been just a joke. So check this out. On July 7th, 1968, the last few shows of the Yardbirds were playing, and the band's starting to dissolve. Nobody wants to really go on tour anymore. They're kind of done jamming with each other. But as the Yardbirds continued to dissolve, a session guitarist, who was very established in his own right, by the name of Jimmy Page, says, "Hey guys, can I keep the name and kind of keep this going?" They're saying, "Sure, go for it." And it was also a little helpful too at the time that the Yardbirds had a few dates that they had to make up in Scandinavia, and the new Yardbirds could fill in some of that slack. I mean, sure, Jimmy Page was the only one left, and who'd ever heard of Robert Plant or John Bonham or John Paul Jones? And some audiences were less than thrilled by that. But after the tour finishes, and later in the year, the future is being pondered upon, so to speak. At the time, Jimmy Page was actually considering starting a supergroup with Jeff Beck on guitar as well, The Who's John Entwistle on bass, and Keith Moon on the drums. Steve Winwood was also possibly tacked on to be the vocalist. And think about that, that would have been hot, but one person who didn't think so was Keith Moon, who gets pitched the idea and says, "What the hell are you guys talking about? That's gonna go down like a lead balloon. Balloon. So Jimmy Page chews on it a little bit. Lead Balloon, Lead Balloon, Led Zeppelin. Let's go bigger, let's go stronger. But even so, they didn't use it right away. Led Zeppelin still played a few more gigs as the new Yardbirds up until Zeppelin 1 was released. Throw it on that cover with the exploding Hindenburg. That was a major moment in rock and roll history. I mean, of course, it did almost get them sued by the Countess Zeppelin, who is the heir to the Zeppelin fortune, for using the picture of the Hindenburg and besmirching the family name, but at least she could know that there wasn't malice intended with the original idea of the name. It was just all the moves made afterwards, but that's a story for another time. But what to play to commemorate this? Why not go with a tune that started as a Yardbirds tune, was played by the new Yardbirds, and became a Zeppelin staple? Seriously, Dazed and Confused was just that. In fact, there's Yardbird covers out there, so influence begets influence sometimes.
Been dazed and confused for so long, it's not true. Wanted a woman, never bargained for you. Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman was created for love.
Even on paper, the idea of the heavy, electric, erotic rock of Jimi Hendrix should not have been a mix with the family-friendly teeny bopper TV show that turned into a band that was the Monkees. Should not have worked. Let's be honest here. All of us know that. But the plan was hatched and it came to fruition on July 8th, 1967, that Jimi Hendrix would open for the Monkees on 30 different shows as the Monkees began a US tour. Here's why it happened. First off, the Monkees loved Jimi Hendrix. They'd seen him in the New York Village. They'd seen him at Monterey Pop. And aside from all the technical skills and great songs, they'd never seen a guy play guitar with his teeth before or while it was on fire. They knew it was going to be something big. So their team called Hendrix's management, and it was actually the management that pressured Jimi Hendrix to do it, because while he'd already had three hit songs in England, he was not breaking ground in the US at the time. Jimi Hendrix, on the other hand, thought that the Monkees' music was, quote, dishwater. He thought it was terrible, even going so far in Melody Maker to say, oh God, I hate them. You can't knock anybody for making it, but people actually like this music? But still, the Monkees liked Hendrix, and they felt like, oh yeah, we're gonna go out, do our thing, but also get to watch Jimi Hendrix night after night. It's gonna be awesome. What could go wrong, right? Everything went wrong, because they start up the first show in Jacksonville, Florida, and these teeny bopping fans who were there to see the Monkees would boo Jimi Hendrix off stage. He'd head out all flamboyant, fire up the amps, start playing Purple Haze. Kids would start booing, and they would drown him out with, "We want Davey!" for Davy Jones. And when Jimi Hendrix would play Foxy Lady, they would change the words to Foxy Davy and then start booing again. It got so bad that literally 8 shows in, a week later on July 16th, Jimi Hendrix on stage flips off the audience, throws down his guitar, and just leaves. No, there's no truth to the rumor that he'd actually been kicked off the tour by the Daughters of the American Revolution because the show was too erotic. He was just frustrated with being booed every single night by kids who wanted bubblegum pop. Now, it worked out for him, but imagine if he'd stayed in it? Scary to think, right? So if you're gonna boo, it's time for you to toddle off. We're not listening to the Monkees here. We're listening to Jimi Hendrix, Foxy Lady. Here we go.
Yeah, I won't do you no harm, no. You got to be all man, all man. Ooh, Foxy Lady.
You know, there could be whole books written on the David Bowie Ziggy Stardust character. I mean, when your starting point is orange-haired, flamboyant, androgynous, rock and roll alien, bisexual, hedonist, starman, god messiah from Mars, and that's just what you can fit on a marquee, you know a lot of people were going to be, still are, and will be in the future mind blown by Ziggy Stardust. But where does something like that come from? Well, to answer that question, we gotta go back to July 9th, 1971, when Bowie starts recording at Trident Studios
videos, some tunes. And the reason I say some tunes and not the album name is because this wasn't supposed to be a concept album. This was just supposed to be the fifth album in David Bowie's, albeit slow-burning, early career. But Bowie's realizing he's gotta break the mold, not only to be who he is as an artist, but to start selling some frickin' records, man. So to get to Ziggy, we have to look at, and there's no nice way of saying this, a failed rock star by the name of Vince Taylor. Now, Vince was also having a lot of troubles in his career, by which I mean he had no career at all. Finally, he has just a complete breakdown. He, bam, loses it. David Bowie meets him one night when he's ranting about how, I'm Vince Taylor, and I'm a cross between a god and an alien, and that strikes a note. Now, you jambalaya that into a pot, with Bowie being fed up with denim and hippie rock and wanting to go somewhere else, and also hanging out with known weirdos Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, and Mark Bolan of T-Rex. Don't forget to combine that with Japanese conceptual art, kabuki, and drag queens, and thus birth the star man, Ziggy Stardust. Now they take these tunes they recorded at Trident on July 9th, 1971, and they scratch and adapt and they write some songs so that they can eventually tell the story that's being told on the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spider from Mars. That Stardust is an androgynous rock star from Mars, sent to Earth ahead of an impending apocalyptic disaster to deliver a message of hope, but he gets hailed as a messiah, succumbs to the attractions of fame, and dies at the end of a rock opera. And still, it slow burns for a while. It's not popular right away. Until July 6th, 1972, when he appears on Top of the Pops in full Ziggy Stardust. And holy man, does it leave an impression. Like, audiences in England are watching this like, what the hell is going on right now? Who is this alien? What are these songs? Why is he grinding up on Mick Ronson like that? It causes an uproar in the punk British audience. But the kids, they're into it, man. The young people, they got tuned in. But surprisingly, for being so well known, Ziggy Stardust wasn't a character for that long. In fact, he lasted just under a year, because by July 3rd, 1973, David Bowie was just, and this is his quote, exhausted and completely bored of Ziggy Stardust. Got to the point where he was in concert and couldn't even pay attention to the performance. He was just, quote, wasted and miserable. So at the Hammersmith Odeon, he kills off Ziggy Stardust. Again, like life imitating art. But that short lightning strike for only a year not only cemented David Bowie's legacy and the ability to evolve and change and still be loved over the next 40 years, but also would go on to inspire bands like the Eurythmics, Joy Division, Depeche Mode, Nine Inch Nails, and even new artists like Kanye or Lady Gaga. Rob Halford said he was untouchable. Chris Cornell said listening to Ziggy Stardust was like going to the college from the Beatles. So I guess it's safe to say life doesn't always imitate art, right? I mean, just because Ziggy fell doesn't mean the man behind him can't rise again.
They came on so loaded, man. Well hung, snow white tan. So where were the spiders while the fly tried to break our bones? Just the beer like to guide us. So we bitched about his fans, and should we crush his sweet?
And with that, that's the end of another Liner Note Leftovers. Crazy to think it's gone by already, but we had some fun and we learned some things. Namely, the only person that could take on the entire rock industry in one go is Neil Young. Still crazy that he got away with that. How one night was all it took for the Clash's role reversal with the Sex Pistols, and how Ziggy Stardust was created by Weird Feelings. His story was about Weird Feelings, and he ended up inspiring Weird Feelings in a whole bunch of different people in a whole bunch of different ways, until David Bowie got the feeling in 73 that he was sick of it and abandoned the thing. There's plenty more stories to be told in the next Liner Note Leftovers, but we're going to call it a day right here. As always, I had a blast going crate digging with you once again, and I hope we get to do it again in episode 16 coming next week. Remember, if you got a story you want featured on Liner Note Leftovers, you can always hit up my day job, 1061 The Goat, on social media. Or, of course, send me an email. That's Daniel M. Soul, S-O-U-L, at gmail.com. I guess all there is to say right now is I love you for coming along once again. And always grab life and your vinyl by the edges. I'll see you in the next one.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to myloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.